So,
what's trending?
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
Why shouldn't you give your kids technology, and should kids under the age of 13 be on Instagram? Why not? We talked about that and so much more, including how to overcome bad habits and change with a therapist today here on Trending. We'll also discuss self-care. Does it really matter that much? And if so, how do you do it? What's so important about this self-care movement? I don't know about you, I'm sick of hearing those words, but is there something to it? We'll discuss what is conversion therapy and how the healing of the paralytic is relevant to each and every single one of us. Welcome to Trending. The number's 1-888-914-9149 if you have a question, or you can always reach out on social media. How is the healing of the paralytic relevant to you and I? Mark chapter 2, we've heard the story time and time again over the years about the man who was lowered down through the roof to see Jesus. But let's set the stage just a little bit. We're reading from Mark chapter 2, and I really want to encourage you. You know, I bring up this story not just so you can sit back and listen, but I want you to go home, sit down, find your Bible. Come on, Catholics, we got to dust it off maybe, and actually read the story. Maybe that's one thing you can work on as Lent continues to progress, is reading scripture at least once daily. So if you want to grow in your faith, this is where I think the story of the paralytic man is so important. Because if we truly understand this story, then it points to this question that we have of whether or not we want to grow our faith. And if you do, whether or not you actually believe that God can make a difference in your life or make you whole, help you to heal from whatever you're experiencing or whatever petitions you might have. If we want to grow in our faith, we'll understand that he's enough, just like those who carry the paralytic man understood, and that he actually forgives your sins, that he can heal you in ways far surpassing what you recognize you even need healing from. So here's a story from Mark chapter 2. Let's set the context. So just before the story of the paralytic man, this is right after Jesus has left Galilee, where he had been preaching in the synagogues, and he'd actually just healed a leper, and the leper had come up to him and actually said, "If you will, you can make me clean." And Jesus did. So then here we are right at the beginning of Mark chapter 2. He's now in Capernaum, and news has gone about that Jesus is home. And we read that there was such a massive crowd surrounding the house that you couldn't even make your way to the house. In fact, the four men carrying the paralytic man, there were so many people gathered, they couldn't make their way to ask Jesus, to plead with Jesus to heal this man. I've often kind of thought, I was reading, were they dragging him? Did one have an arm, another arm, a leg, and a leg? You know, how did they bring the paralytic man? Well, it actually says in the story, he was on a pallet. They couldn't get through the crowd, so what did they do? They opened the roof and let him down through a hole they made in the roof. Now, to set the context, to be clear, you know, they didn't have the same type of roofs that we do today, where you would have, you know, all, you would have to like literally take like a hammer, a jacksaw, and an axe to get through the roof. You know, it was different. They had plates, kind of like tile plates out of usually burnt clay, and then they'd have insulation on top of that. So it wasn't like they were actually making a hole. They did make a hole, but it was fixable. It was something that was removable. So they made this hole in the roof for this paralytic man, and they let him down on a pallet, these four men. I want you to remember this for a moment. We should have the same type of faith. I'd call it through the roof faith. And I'm not one for silly slogans, but I was really thinking about this. They had such a great faith. They were willing to make a hole in the roof of the Son of God's house in order to bring this man to him. I think that that's pretty profound. That someone, in fact, four people would have such a profound through the roof faith, as I call it, that they entrusted this man to God. And it made me ask this question. His friends knew that what he needed was Jesus Christ. So the question is, do our friends know that what we need when something goes wrong is Jesus Christ? I think it's an important question, because do we show our friends the same faith, or do we try to fix them ourselves? Raise your hand. I know I do. Try to fix our friends. Try to fix what's wrong. Our friends who are single, our friends who are going through marital difficulties, who aren't sleeping enough, who aren't eating right. You know, how many people, I love nutrition, I love kind of health stuff and exercise, and there have been so many times where a friend or a family member is going on about their health journey, and I just want to get in there and be like, you should try this, you should do this, and I get it wrong, and I do say those things, and I annoy them to no avail at times. But even with the health issue and everything else, we're going to talk about, is self-care, is, quote, me time, actually a thing that we need? Because I think it's important to talk about these trendy slogans and ideas to take care of ourselves that are in the culture but actually relate to our faith, and we will. But again, I come back to this question. Do we show our friends the same level of faith that the four friends of the paralytic showed him? And see, what happens in this story when we entrust ourselves to Jesus Christ and his will that he has for us? Well, four things happen in this story. One, he heals the man just like he will heal you. Two, he actually gives us what we need, not just what we want. In fact, we read, when he saw their faith, and it was the faith of his friends, he said, "My son, your sins are forgiven." Notice, he actually didn't heal him of his paralysis first. No, he didn't even acknowledge the paralysis. The first thing he did is, "My son, your sins are forgiven." He forgave him his sins, blotted out his sins. And I think that's so important that we realize, then he heals the paralytic and he says, "Arise, take up your pallet and go home." And the Pharisees who were there in the face of this, they were upset before Jesus even healed the paralysis. They were upset because Jesus said, "Go, your sins are forgiven." That's what they were the most upset about. Why? Because the forgiveness of sins is something, that's something only God could do. And Jesus was claiming to be God if he was claiming to forgive the sins of the paralytic. And so this draws us yet again to the idea of abandoning ourselves to God, of trusting that his will for us is better than anything that you and I could have in store for ourselves, and that he does answer our prayers, but often he gives us what we need before what we want. And in fact, what we want may change once he's given us what we need. And so I want to encourage you to have that through the roof faith in God. And I want to encourage you yet again to pray the prayer of abandonment. It's my favorite prayer, and we'll post it again right now on social media, because it's such a simple prayer, but it really does prepare us for the will of God, even when it's not what we want. But in the prayer itself, it acknowledges that we'll have what we need in order to make it happen, whatever that will of God is. So go check it out. We'll post it now, especially on Twitter and Facebook. You can find it. You're listening to Trending with Timory. If you haven't already, head over to relevantradio.com/trending to connect. I'd love to hear from you. What's going on in your life? What would you like to hear discussed? And better question, have you subscribed to the podcast so that you don't miss an episode? Coming up, why shouldn't you give your kids technology? Joining me today is a dear friend of the show, marriage and family therapist Michael Gasparo. He works with the Breakthrough Clinic and Reintegrative Therapy, which we'll talk about a little bit later on today. But as we're in the middle of Lent, there's this idea of growing and mortification, asceticism in the tradition of doing things such as behavior modification in order to overcome bad habits and sin. And so it kind of makes us ask this question, dare we hope that we can live in accord with our faith? Lent is that reminder that God changes things and that you have the ability to grow. You see, Lent shakes us out of our laziness and even our comfort into a faith that moves mountains. And so Do you believe that you can make a change in your life? If you do, I want to really dive into this with Associate Marriage and Family Therapist Michael Gasparo. Let's talk about making changes. Can we use behavior modification, Michael, as a tactic to overcome bad habits and sin?
The first part of the question, I think, is really interesting because virtues, as my friend Dr. Chris Kaser at LMU has said, are these habits for happiness. And bad habits, these vices, are the habits that take us away from the happiness promised when we become like God and we share in God's own happiness. So as the Catechism of the Catholic Church puts it, the goal of the virtuous life is to become like God, and in becoming like God, we share in God's own happiness. So I think it's helpful to frame this in terms of what's that desire for happiness that we feel within ourselves, and how can we move towards it instead of just thinking, I need to take away these toys, these vices that are so much fun. The Christian life is really the happy life when we can live in a way that the virtuous habits we build support our likeness in God's image.
This reminds me a lot of the writings of Aristotle, his book, The Nicomachean Ethics. If you haven't read it, I highly, highly recommend reading it. In The Nicomachean Ethics, the entire book is basically about happiness. And the answer is, how do you find happiness? Well, through virtue. And that's so important, I think, to understand, because virtue, it's hard to get there because we have so many little things that we've picked up along the way that tend to decrease our tendency toward doing good, toward being kind, toward being chivalrous and courageous. And so I think this is where, you know, a Catholic understanding of the fact that we have to will that something will occur. And if we don't will it to happen, it won't happen. And so I think the whole idea, first and foremost, Michael, is that we have to want it before we can even work toward it.
Wanting it is important, and that requires a level of awareness. And so having self-awareness is a really good first step in knowing that there's even a habit to break. So I would argue that research supports, and even Christian experience of the average Christian person, breaking a bad habit is a little harder than starting a new good habit. It takes a little bit more time and effort, and also, by the way, the grace of God, right? So that's the basis for all of what we do and accomplish in this life, is predicated on this belief of the primacy of God's grace and tapping into that. But in order to start the breaking of a habit, or looking at that vice that's keeping you from virtue, it helps, as Dr. Kaser says, to study the habit. So I love his metaphor in his book, The Gospel of Happiness, that a hunter is more likely to be successful in killing a mountain lion if he knows all about it, where and when it eats, where it sleeps, the trails it goes on most frequently, etc. So maybe one of the first and most important steps of breaking a habit is to study it and to learn more about it. And Thomas Aquinas actually references this in Summa Theologiae. I mispronounced that, sorry. I was thinking Summa Theologica, but St. Thomas Aquinas listed possible circumstances as follows. When you're studying a habit, Timory, think of who, what, where, by what aids, how, why, and when, in the first basic exploration of what is cueing me or prompting me to do this habit.
Okay, so let's talk about an example. I was talking a lot a couple weeks ago about detachment. And if you didn't catch that episode, we'll post the link on Twitter now, because it's so important to understand that often when we are angry about something, when we have an angry response, it's a sign of an attachment to something. And it could be a quick lashing out over something. You know, it might have something to do with the way dishes are put away, the way things are done, you know, these simple little reactions that we have that we act upon. And so let's use this as an example to overcome some of our attachments that are peeking their head because we see this angry lashing out based on our reactions. How do we overcome the habit of that angry reaction?
All habits have three basic parts. So this is something to consider. One conceptualization of habits. They have three basic parts: cue, routine, and reward. So when you're talking about changing this reaction, that first part I mentioned is studying the cues. What are the triggers, as some people would say, about this particular habit? Whenever you go out with a special friend, that's the friend you always end up drinking too much alcohol with, for instance. Or is it a time of night where you know if you stay up past midnight, past that time, you know, what do they say? Nothing good happens after 1 a.m. or whatever, 11 p.m., depending on who you are.
10 o'clock, so, come on.
Depends on who you are, I guess. So whenever you're looking for the cues, that's the first step. The second step, I would say, and Dr. Kaiser argues, is the routine. And the third is the reward. And I'll explain briefly in a specific example. If every time I go to a specific restaurant, I eat in this particular order, get this particular thing, and then I end up feeling really full after double lobster and triple steak, that's the routine I'm in. So I've got to study and learn, what is this routine's payoff? What do I get from this? What's the reward from it? And as I learn to examine this habit through the cue, my friend always invites me to this old restaurant with a giant buffet, the routine, I eat way too much of every item because I do the all-you-can-eat buffet, and the reward, well, I love doing it because it helps me avoid dealing with my problems, and I don't really have to think much while I'm gorging myself on food. When we examine this cue routine reward pattern, we can learn a lot more about why we do what we do and begin to implement strategies to change up our reactions to the cues and interrupt that cycle before it starts.
So help me, is that part of the routine side of things?
Well, so the routine can change, right? So we might always have the cue that's present. This is why people who struggle with, let's say, alcohol addiction, people in Alcoholics Anonymous say they're a recovering alcoholic, because there still might be a cue sometimes. They walk past a liquor store and it triggers memories of their times going in and purchasing alcohol. That'd be a cue to go back to that old pattern, that old habit. However, in that moment, if they're aware of their normal routine and the payoff, they might say, how can I do this differently? What routine can I change here? Well, I know that I liked to drink because I helped me feel less lonely. And so that was the reward I got. And the routine was always walking into this store. So I'm going to take a different route to work. I'm going to change my routine so I don't have to go by that store. And I'm going to notice when I'm pulled to doing that, I'm going to call a friend instead and reach out to my sponsor at AA to help me get the reward that I sought, which was connection and not feeling lonely, but maybe get it in a different way, in a healthier way that helps still support the breaking of this habit pattern.
You know, this is really fascinating, because later on, I wish you could stay with us the whole show. We're going to be talking about this whole me time self-help movement, because I think this touches on really our bad habits touch on ultimately this need for the so-called self-care, because we're looking for the reward of rest or kind of filling back up our tank of energy and recuperation or even just joy activities, but we're not getting them because we're turning to bad habits and essentially coping mechanisms that are getting in the way of us actually making changes to do better. And I think a big coping mechanism, for example, is just picking up our phone and scrolling through social media instead of doing something to make a change and to deal with a bad habit.
That's a great point. Rest is a very complex term, and I love that you use that term, because when we tell people to rest in peace, we hope that they are in heaven. Well, they're not just sleeping in heaven, right? So rest is not just sleeping or laying around. It's an idea of emotional and psychological being energized emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. So like you said, maybe some things that trigger our autopilot mode, like scrolling on our phone mindlessly, are far less restful than perhaps actively participating in a good new habit, like exercising a hobby or going to do some physical exercise, even let's say going for a jog or playing the piano, things that engage our mind and our body where we rest in good habits and not just in being lazy.
So the reward you're talking about, and if you're just joining us, that's Associate Marriage and Family Therapist Michael Gasparo with Reintegrative Therapy, and we're talking about making good habits. So you talked about the reward, how ultimately the reward is our goal. Even if we pick up our bad habits to try and fulfill that goal, we can change the routine to develop virtue ultimately. So the purpose, I think, is so important for us to see. We have to have a purpose in order for things to change. Let's say, for example, I really want to quit sugar because I want to be more mentally alert, happier, have more energy, even be more present when I'm praying because I'm just so lethargic, perhaps. Or even be charitable toward others. Maybe the sugar is making me have a short temper. And so if I want to quit sugar, it needs to not just be about stopping sugar, but the purpose behind it ultimately. So how can this purpose kind of walk us through understanding who we are and kind of having hope in that ability to change?
The purpose of changing a habit should come because you know it's costing you something. And when that cost is becoming apparent through self-awareness and self-knowledge, it can provide the needed motivation to begin this change process. So a vice costs us because it's not leading us to God, which is our ultimate happiness. So for this case, and the one you're describing of breaking bad habits versus implementing a new one, there's a slightly different approach, I would say, to each thing. Breaking an old habit might take longer than starting a new one. If you're going to lead towards breaking an old habit, one of the most important things, like you're saying, is having a purpose, but also not trying to pile too much on at once. I don't know if you've ever been there, but I have, where I'm like, I'm going to change this and that. I'm going to go to bed at this time. I'm going to change 12 things at once. And a lot of research into positive psychology and supported, I would even say, by the Christian life is patience and gradualness. So Pick one thing, start with one thing. And that thing, the purpose, Timri, you could ask yourself, is this leading me towards God and towards a fulfilling of my vocation? Or is this detracting from that in some way? And I think that can be a purpose to explore.
And this is a really good point, because I know many men in particular are engaging in the Exodus 90 program, a 90-day Catholic spiritual exercise for men. And it is rigorous, from cold showers, no sugar, off social media, to the rigor of the prayer life, etc. And I know some men, you know, really thrive on checking all the boxes and making it happen, and there's tremendous growth. But I know for others, there are so many things that they are working on at once that the intensity of it leads some to burnout. And so I want to come back briefly here and talk about how we can kind of be patient with ourselves when we set up big to-do lists to grow, and also how we can talk about what freedom is with regard to therapy when it's time to turn to a therapist to help us break those bad habits. So we'll be right back with Associate Marriage and Family Therapist Michael Gasparo here on Trending, and also, why shouldn't your kids have technology? What do you remember about your wedding vows? Did you understand the gravity of them at your marriage? Or did you not come to the powerful understanding of the sacrament until later? This is Timri from Trending with Timri. Thursday, during our weekly marriage hour, I want to hear from you. What do you remember about your wedding vows? Also, what do you do when your spouse doesn't want to have children? Join me daily at 6 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio or the Relevant Radio app. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timri on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
If you go to therapy, shouldn't you have the right to choose who your therapist is? Shouldn't you have the right to choose what kind of therapy you want to go through? Well, freedom of therapy is actually under attack. We're going to talk about that in just a minute, because this is important. We've been talking about breaking bad habits, overcoming sin, and for many of us, we could use that extra help. We could use the help of turning to a therapist to help us overcome maybe some of those origin wounds that have been impacting our ability to grow. And so we'll come to that in just a moment. But we ended here with Associate Marriage and Family Therapist Michael Gasparo from Reintegrative Therapy. And we were talking about how sometimes when we try to make a change, we make this whole litany of things we are going to start doing. And maybe this is how you started your Lent. Michael, what do you do when you have so many things you know you have to change, you want to change, and you know they have to change, but there's so much that when you start out, you kind of just fall apart at the very beginning of the attempt?
Well, first of all, I've been there. Second of all, Lent is not just Lent and sacrifice is the, you know, asceticism and the practices of the three pillars of Lent, of prayer, almsgiving, and fasting. They're not just about ridding yourself of vices. They're about maybe taking away sometimes even good things or adding good things to help us shift our spiritual focus and to engage in penance, etc. So when you mentioned Exodus 90, that very well may be a great program. And those are often not necessarily habits that those people plan to commit to for the extension beyond that period of time. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. So it may be more possible to make significant changes in several areas when it's for a short-term, group-oriented practice or during Lent. What I'm speaking more specifically to is breaking a bad habit that's a vice that you want to continue with throughout. And maybe Lent is a good time to start that, to implement this habit-breaking process during Lent and continue it past Lent. But research generally supports the idea that making too many things on your list of habits to break, even more than one sometimes, can lead to that sense of burnout, like you mentioned. So one of the most vital parts of stopping that burnout process is to have an alternative in plan or in place. So instead of saying, I won't do this, think I will do that. So instead of saying, I won't smoke a cigarette today, you can even add something small, like I will chew a toothpick today every time I wanted to grab a cigarette and smoke. So having an alternative plan in place prepares you for success in the very earliest stages of your habit shifting or vice breaking process. And I would remind everyone too that prayer, essentially dependence and closeness with God, is going to be an essential part of any shift in our spiritual life as is.
That's Associate Marriage and Family Therapist Michael Gasparo. Let's talk about freedom and therapy, and specifically, quote, conversion therapy. News broke a couple weeks ago that well-known political commentator Milo Yiannopoulos, who has been outwardly gay and Catholic, practicing Catholic for a number of years, has said that he's consecrated his life to St. Joseph and he's no longer gay. Sure, he said that he struggles still with temptation, but one really interesting thing that came out about Milo Yiannopoulos, and if you know nothing about him, we'll post a link on social media to the conversation we had a couple weeks ago. We'll post that now on Twitter. But Milo is fascinating because he's someone who has been abused at the hands of a priest, has struggled with same-sex attraction for years, had a quote-unquote partner, marriage, whatever he wants to call it, and yet he's said this whole time, what the church teaches is correct, I stand by it, this is what I want, but basically said he's not there yet. And so here he is now with this massive news of he's given his life, I think even over in a more profound way, to our Lord, saying, you know, I want to make changes in my life. I'm no longer gay. Yes, I'm struggling. But here's the big thing that is fascinating. When people have asked him, well, what's next? He made the comment that his professional and personal priorities have changed. And he talked about how, quote, over the next decade, I would like to help rehabilitate what the media calls, quote, conversion therapy. He said, it does work, and albeit not for everybody. Can you speak a little bit to what he's speaking of here?
Reintegrative therapy, and reintegrativetherapy.com is one place you can go to visit a little bit more about our clinic, focuses especially for people who want to live a life that is not in line with the mainstream culture's interpretation of having same-sex attractions. More specifically, many men that come to having therapy for these types of issues want to have support to try to live according to their conscience. Maybe they're Catholic, or maybe they follow another religion like Islam or Judaism, where homosexual acts and practices are not in line with their deeply held religious values and beliefs. And so what we try to do in therapy is support their own predetermined self-guided interests to live according to their conscience. One of the things we do in reintegrative therapy, and this is what Milo Yiannopoulos has referred to a couple of times, even using a term that our clinic used to use, which is reparative therapy, is look at, as you alluded to earlier, Timri, underlying experiences in our lives, especially in the realm of emotional healing, in terms of relationships, traumas, behavior addictions, or even obsessive compulsive issues, along with other neurotic repressive challenges that individuals go through, and bring attention and healing through standard evidence-based psychotherapy practices to these areas of their lives that can support a transformation of both the experience of same-sex attraction, leading for many people to a reduction in those attractions and temptations, and also to the exploration of the possibility of living a life in accord with their conscience, perhaps as a married man, or even as a single person who is in touch with their God-given gift of sexuality in a more full, heal, and hold way, where they might find an increase in their attractions and desires towards sexual union with a woman one day.
And
this,
Michael,
is possible.
And this is what's crazy to me, that there is an attempt to shut down a therapist's ability to work with a person who has come to them because they want to work with that therapist, when in reality what we're talking about is that the idea that someone could work with a therapist to help them be chaste, that is to help them not do things they don't want to do. And I mean, that is just baffling that we are literally saying at this point in history, and this is part of the problem with the Equality Act, which you and I will unpack more in the coming weeks, mm-hmm. is that it's to say that you cannot do the very things that you want to do that fall in line with your faith, and you can't work with a therapist to help you do that. It's basically a violation of free will and saying that you are not capable or able, and we're just going to force you into whatever new identity you've given yourself. And this is what's so sad, Michael. We have people such as Milo Yiannopoulos, who has been abused by a priest. We have people like the singer Demi Lovato, who has been raped and abused as well. And these people truly have tend to turn to their intimacy with the wrong types of people as a coping mechanism. And so for us to not even be able to touch on or address that or help them when they want to live otherwise is an absolute travesty.
And it's important, too, that Milo is highlighting an aspect of his process here, which he said openly is a spiritual process. And spirituality can be incorporated into the therapy room, especially if you're going to see a Catholic therapist, for instance. But it's also important to remember that that spiritual component is about wholeness. He consecrated his life to St. Joseph, and he spoke openly about that. We're in the year of St. Joseph, as I know you speak a lot on your show about, and you've spoken with me too about Dan Calloway and the consecration of St. Joseph. That's a beautiful book and a beautiful process. Let's not underestimate the role of spirituality in people's journeys and the role that people like St. Joseph have in the lives of Catholics in terms of modeling both chastity, but also emotional wholeness. And we set ourselves up to live according to our conscience. And for those people, including myself, who've experienced same-sex attraction, we help ourselves live according to our conscience when we attend to our emotional lives and we heal our emotional lives so that we can use the emotions as they were given to us by God to aid us in choosing good and fleeing from evil. And reparative and reintegrative therapy is a way of exploring how that healing process looks using standard evidence-based psychotherapy practices.
Michael, I love when you're on because you really do help emphasize the ability that people in the face of whatever thing they are battling, whatever it is for each of us, whatever disorders we experience from our bad habits of eating too much sugar that causes disorder in our body and an inability to function properly, to our bad habits in our marriage. I know, right? You know, all of these bad habits, it is possible through the grace of God, through the intervention of good, faith-filled therapists, and the will of ourselves to actually want to make that change, that it is possible. We can live in accord with our faith. And I think that that message is so hope-filled, especially as we have this culture where we tend to identify ourselves by our sin. And what you're doing at the reintegrative therapy, helping especially people who experience same-sex attraction to work through that, is so important. Can you share just a little bit more about reintegrative therapy, which is what Milo is referring to when people talk about, quote, conversion therapy, which is what it's not. Where people think conversion therapy is, you know, forcing people to take Ipecac and look at images of people of the opposite sex and, you know, kind of trying to retrain the brain based on these torture methods, which is not what reintegrative therapy is.
Conversion therapy is ill-defined. There's no governing body. There's no real clear identification of what it actually even is in the laws that reference it. In fact, it's really just sort of dog whistle language for people that are antithetical or hold antithetical views to traditional Christian ethics on sexuality and morality. So what we want to emphasize at the Reintegrative Therapy Clinic and what partners through other organizations like ours around the country who are doing great work with individuals who struggle with same-sex attraction or other sexual chaos in their lives and sexual brokenness is that each person deserves the right to attend therapy that will support them in their own goals for their conscience according to their religious, deeply held values. Reintegrative therapy focuses on being extremely careful to support clients through interventions that lead towards emotional wholeness. If sexuality shifts as a result, that is a secondary byproduct. We don't change people's sexuality. We don't try to change their orientation. We try to support emotional healing, relational wholeness. And remember, the dirty secret in the American psychological community is that secular research shows that sexuality can be fluid for some people, moving from homosexuality towards heterosexuality, and sometimes in the other direction because of experimentation, etc. It just seems that the secular media is fine if someone chooses to experiment with homosexuality, but the moment somebody with deeply held religious values says they want to explore their heterosexual potential through exploring their wounds and the environmental things that contributed to their experiences, all of a sudden that's a problem. And that's because there's a deeply held bias against the belief that the truth is sexuality is meant to be lived between a man and a woman in marriage, ideally. No one is perfect. We all have wounds and struggles, but it's okay to establish norms and support people in trying to strive for those healthy, happy norms.
And what you're talking about is undoing trauma through healing, helping to address obsessive compulsive disorder, helping to address traumas and behaviors and improper bonding, lack of affirmation that took root at an earlier point in our lives that can be healed, that can help us be whole again. Again, that's why this whole idea of reintegration, reintegrating us into society as human beings fully developed and formed in our spirituality and our mental capacities, I think are so important for us to be discussing. So what you're doing there is incredible. I highly encourage, go to the reintegrativetherapy.com. I'll post links in the show notes that'll go up in the podcast this evening, because the story's there. Alone, even if you don't know someone who needs this, go have this website in your back pocket, because I can't tell you how many moms, dads have written to me about their kids who are struggling with identity disorders, especially during COVID because of this isolation. And so check them out, reintegrativetherapy.com. Watch the stories, see the witness of those people who have been changed and were finding such a great amount of peace and joy and living out a chaste lifestyle. That's Associate Marriage and Family Therapist Michael Gasparo. Always great to have you, Michael. Thanks for joining us. I'll be right back and we'll discuss whether or not kids under 13 should be on Instagram.
We're talking about what you're thinking about. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
What is it with this whole self-care me time movement? I can't stand the words me time, but we'll talk about it in just a little bit because it ties into everything we've been discussing today, getting rid of bad habits and sin in our life. But first, should kids under the age of 13 have social media? It should be a logical no. But unfortunately, comfort has led so many of us to just do what's easy and let hours pass by without actually realizing what the consequences are. So we're going to talk about the consequences of not just social media use, but technology use underage. And why is this a big deal? Well, Instagram is actually working on a platform for kids, so that kids under the age of 13 can be on their version of Instagram. Now, apart from the whole internet safety and this actually being a pedophilia playground by creating this, let's talk about the technological impact on a kid's brain, because that whole side of it is horrible and it has to be stated, because it is. Let's just tell people, here's where a bunch of 13-year-old underage kids are. Come on. It's already bad enough that they're on social media the way they are, but that's even worse. So let's go into the impact on the brain of the kid. So why shouldn't your kid have technology? Well, one, they can't regulate it the way an adult can. And we'll talk about that more briefly in a minute. Two, it prevents their brain from developing properly. And three, it prevents the proper development of interpersonal skills for kids. So the goal for you as a parent, or as a future parent, or even as a person who's developed, is to become a mature person. The responsibility of parents is the education of their children. And we're talking about the spiritual education, the physical development, and the nourishment. We're talking about the intellectual development. We're talking about so many areas of how a person develops to create a whole integrated human being. Now, a lot of that has to do with their brain and their emotional interaction. Now, there is this book written by a psychotherapist and addiction specialist. His name is Nicholas Kadaris, and he's the author of Glow Kids. And if you have not heard of this book, and you are a parent or you know a parent, or you're just fascinated with brain science and what technology's impact is on the brain, you need to buy this book. Again, it's called Glow Kids, How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids. It came out, I think, somewhere around 5+ years ago. Fantastic book. But here's the deal. We need to talk about what's happening with kids and their brains. Some of the reports have come out as of 2019, and it's only gone up with COVID, that on average, a teen spends an average of 7 hours per day on screen media strictly for entertainment. So this doesn't include any of their homework, schoolwork, or digital learning. So on average, just for entertainment, teenagers are spending 7 hours per day. Remember, that's an average. So it's much higher for some and lower for others. Now, on average for tweens, kind of that middle school age, they're spending about 5 hours a day. Here's the reality. This addiction specialist, Nicholas Kadaris, has commented that children are getting into a transcendental state with their technology. That's why he calls them glow kids. Now, is this just us evolving as a society and we have to adapt to technology? Because people have complained that with every new technological advancement, people of faith or people in general tend to say, ooh, it's of the devil, it's evil. I remember one time, I think my brother said to me, oh, you just think social media is of the devil. I said, no, I think social media is great. I love it. But I think the way we use it is really damaging, especially when we are younger. Or when we can't detach from it, or when we can't look people in the face. And we're going to touch on all of that in just a bit. And it's funny because then I started slamming like facts at him and one of my other siblings, and my husband's like, yeah, don't mess with her on social media. And suddenly my brother went from thinking that I was like this crazy person that thought new technology was of the devil to going, oh, there's actually something legit to it being problematic. And so here's the reality. It's not just evolving societies turning to new types of technology. Technology has to be age appropriate. We have to understand that children's developing brains are actually very fragile. And there's a difference, actually, between TV, which is a passive stimulation, versus phone technology, tablets, computers, which are actually stimulating technologies. Now, what's happening is we're seeing an effect in the prefrontal cortex of the child's brain, and that it's being impacted basically the same exact way, listen to this, are you listening? As if your kid was on cocaine. Technology use for a developing brain has the same impact as cocaine, and it impacts their brain development. No one's saying that. Back technology companies, the media, no one. Why? Because they make money off of your eyeballs engaging, clicking, interacting, and sharing. They make money for you emoting your emotions and your thoughts and sharing ideas, sharing photos, communicating with family and friends and loved ones on social media. But we're handing this to kids and we're literally handing them cocaine. So what is an addiction? Because I remember some years ago, someone I esteem highly disagreed with me when I kept saying pornography is an addiction. And no, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. And we went toe-to-toe on this for months, and finally they said, okay, yeah, pornography is an addiction. Well, why? Because an addiction is a behavior or a substance that negatively impacts your life. Now, the substance, pornography, can be a substance, because, and what's scary is that it's actually not even something you have to take. Similarly, with technology, it's not something you have to ingest. And that's what's so scary, is that what actually the addiction is to the chemical reactions of how we're engaging It's so the dopamine hits for the notifications that we receive and the likes we receive. So actually, it's your brain creating the chemical instead of your body taking the drug. That's even worse. This is a digital drug. So what are some warning signs for you as a parent that your kids being impacted by technology? Big one, mood dysregulation. What happens if you take that device away from yourself? What happens if you take it away from your kid? I know so many parents who say, oh, I only let my kid have X so much time on technology. And then I'm standing there as they take the technology away and the kid throws a fit for the next 2 hours because the technology was taken away and they want it back. An indicator of an addiction is very strong here for many kids. So here's the reality. Kids are suffering. They're suffering developmentally, they're suffering interpersonally, and they're suffering neurologically. Kids are decreasing their mobility, social interaction, they're not reading. In fact, think about this. They're actually not even being nourished properly because they're foregoing eating to stay on whatever technology they're on. Hello? Don't you do this too? I know I do. If I can't regulate when I'm eating because I'm staying on my technology, a kid is going to be in far worse shape. And let's talk about this even further. People are literally not using their proper bodily functions. Come on, we'll talk about it. Using the restroom because they're on their technologies. It's creating hemorrhoid issues. It is creating, yes, I went there. It is creating constipation issues. I mean, we could go on and on. Literally, people are having issues with proper bodily functions because there, Karen's looking at me, which you could see her face. Lucas is like, you went there. Yeah, but we have to talk about that because I know so many people where they're saying, I don't know why my kid has all this trouble. And the reality is that a lot of these digestive issues can come back in a state to lack of paying attention to eating foods because we're distracted by what we're watching. We're turning to the junk food because we're engaged in our social media, and finally we're binge eating because we delayed so long. And so I think that all of this is so important because we're creating dopamine reactions where we're preferring to stay on technology than function as a proper human being with eating, drinking, sleeping, all the important things. And recognize the big difference between us and kids. Adults have a developed prefrontal cortex that can help give them the context and a greater ability to self-regulate. Kids can't self-regulate their work, their use of technology. We can't even self-regulate our distractions on technology. How are kids managing in this new online learning environment during COVID? No wonder so many kids are having struggles. Listen, developmental windows actually really do matter for kids. And kids are losing fundamental skills because these developmental windows in various age brackets are being damaged completely, especially the prefrontal cortex development, by technology use. As a parent, you have kids who are entrusted to your care. Your job is to help navigate this and form a fully developed human being. It doesn't matter what's comfortable and what's easier. Today, there's a problem of emotional, psychological, and interpersonal development. In fact, it's been clear that ADHD increase is due, in one part, to the fact that those fundamental development windows are not being impacted properly because of technology use. Also, studies have shown that kids are supposed to have about 70% or eye contact about 70% of the time. Kids have on average less than 20% eye contact. That's a huge gap. They cannot make eye contact. They cannot carry on conversations. We'll have to take up this whole idea another day in relation to school and the impact of online learning. Because get this, just a little seed to implant. Even in Silicon Valley, the top creators of technology do not give screens to their kids until they're well into their teen years. So why are we? Let's help provide better entertainment through reading, going outside, starting a craft, playing a sport, going hiking. Join me tomorrow during our weekly marriage hour here on Trending. What do you remember about your wedding vows? Did you understand the gravity of them at your marriage? Or did you not come to the powerful understanding of the sacrament until later? This is Timmy from Trending with Timmy. Thursday, during our weekly marriage hour, I want to hear from you. What do you remember about your wedding vows? Also, what do you do when your spouse doesn't want to have children? Join me daily at 6 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio or the Relevant Radio app.